The other point I want to make here is about the term that Whitman uses, which is physiognomy. And that becomes, physiognomy means the ability to understand someone's soul or character based on their physical traits. And Whitman uses that term physiognomy, and I think that that's relevant throughout the Leaves of Grass and throughout Song of Myself in two ways. One is that he's interested in the connection between the character or the soul of the nation and the physical traits and activities of its members. Its literal body. And also, it's relevant in terms of the relationship between Whitman the poet's physiognomy and the character of his poetry, which is to say that if you look at the 1855 edition, which you have in front of you, you will see what was printed on the frontispiece of the text, a drawing, a sketch of Whitman in a kind of, the term gets used from art history and Renaissance art, but it's a kind of contrapposto position, which is to say that he's sort of standing straight up, but he has his hand on his waist, his kind of leaned, he's kind of cocked to one side. Notice the clothing that he has on. He describes a poetry about and for the beards and the ruffs. These were terms used for working class men who hung around New York City. So he has a look of someone who is very working class. And that's always been an important kind of signifier, that image of Whitman and what that means for his poetry, that it's a poetry for these people, for working class people, for ordinary people, but also it's about, it reflects the lives of Americans, and ordinary Americans. And so he wants the image of himself and to be sort of representative of the persona and the character of the poetry. And I think you see that in the opening of Song of Myself, and you see that throughout the poems, that he is talking about a kind of nobility of the body. And that he's talking about, and particularly it's distinctly a masculine body, right? And in fact, the issue of sort of Whitman and women is a fascinating question. There have been a lot of feminist critiques of his poetry. However, he does, and he often, Whitman has, moments of intense sexism and chauvinism in his poetry, where he sort of reduces the role of women to be the mothers for the men. But he also has moments, and we'll probably take a look at one in a second, where women are really sort of given a kind of dignity and equality that they had not been in poetry up until this point, had not been given. So let's take a look at the opening, and I'll read a little bit from the beginning and we'll discuss it for a minute, and then we'll kind of jump around. So he starts by saying, "I celebrate myself and what I assume you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. Houses and rooms are full of perfumes. The shelves are crowded with perfumes. I breathe the fragrance myself and know it and like it. The distillation would intoxicate me also, but I shall not let it. The atmosphere is not a perfume. It has no taste of the distillation. It is odorless. It is for my mouth forever. I am in love with it. I will go to the bank by the wood and become undisguised and naked. I am mad for it to be in contact with me. The smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, and buzz whispers. Love root, silk thread, crotch and vine, my respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green leaves and dry leaves, and of the shore and dark-colored sea rocks, and of hay in the barn. The sound of the belched words of my voice. And here you can hear Griswold just, ugh, how gross, right? Words loose to the eddies of the wind. A few light kisses, a few embraces, a reaching around of arms. The play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag. The delight alone or in the rush of the streets or along the fields and hillsides. The feeling of health, the full noon trill, the song of me rising from bed and meeting the sun. Have you reckoned 1,000 acres much? Have you reckoned the earth much? Have you practiced so long to learn to read? Have you felt so proud to get at the meaning of poems? Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them for yourself, from yourself. And then, a couple things to notice here. There's a real movement to the poetry. By that I mean movement to the speaker, from the speaker. He is moving through spaces, and it's. I think it operates on a semi-unconscious level, but I think if you read it, you can see that. You can start to picture. This is why Whitman is known as the sort of the great flaneur poet. Is that there's a speaker who's on the move, and who's walking around, who starts at home, and goes out into the street, and we see sort of city images in the beginning of the poem, and as it progresses, he moves through sort of countrysides and small towns, and sometimes throughout his poems. He's going into the heartland, so to speak, the Western territories. So he's moving through spaces and recording, in trying to record the poem of America. He's moving through America and recording its different spaces and its different cultures and people. But also, one thing to notice here too is that there's this emphasis on perfume, the perfume of the indoors. So we have this juxtaposition of the Victorian household and the sort of the Victorian or antebellum, maybe we could even say drawing room or parlor of genteel society, juxtaposed with the outdoors. And this is very gendered for Whitman, right? Like the indoors are very feminine or effeminate. But they're also there's a degree of artifice to it, right? The perfume is something that is, it's an odor that's intoxicating, but it's artificial, right? And if you leave the home and you go into the woods, where Whitman's saying, I'm called out into nature, I'm called out into the woods or to outdoors. That's coded as in his poetry as masculine. It signifies as masculine, and really for Whitman that means not necessarily men are superior to women, but it means that he's interested in a poetry that celebrates nature and also working class people and the ordinary, and not sort of the artificial and the refined, right? Which he associates with being kind of effeminate, right? And so one way to think of it, you might frame it like the antebellum drawing room or the genteel house of antebellum America is the kind of stanzaic structure, formal structure of traditional poetry. And the outdoors is Whitman's alternative to that traditional style and that traditional structure. So he wants to leave the confines of the stanza and the confines of traditional poetic subject matter and sort of go out and explore what the new subject matter is going to be. And that's going to include things traditionally excluded from poetry: the body, sex, lots of sex, labor, working class people, and different races. He's going to talk about different races and embrace racial diversity. And he's going to try and collapse these sort of social hierarchies and sort of put everyone on an equal playing field, or give everyone equal status. So let us jump forward a little bit and look at one or two more instances, and then that'll be it. He also says shortly thereafter, "I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. Loaf with me on the grass, loose the stop from your throat. Not words, not music or rhyme I want, not custom or lecture, not even the best. Only the lull I like, the hum of your valved voice. I mind how we lay in June, such a transparent summer morning. You settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me and parted the shirt from my bosom bone and plunged your tongue to my bare-stripped heart and reached till you felt my beard and reached till you held my feet." You notice in this part too that this goes back to the physiognomy of the drawing of the poet, and this emphasis on physiognomy is the figure of the poet who sort of stands, who loafs and leans and sort of stands back, is the posture, is the character that the poems are trying to take, which is it's taking a sturdy but non-judgmental posture, sort of saying, "I'm interested in all forms of life because I think they offer good things, and I want to celebrate all forms of life. I want to celebrate the pluralism of American life, but I don't want to make a judgment on it. I don't want to hierarchize it. I don't want to privilege one thing over the other. I want to sort of celebrate all of it." That's sort of the other side of, it's not so much a disinterestedness as it is, or a stoicism, I think, as it is a commitment to sort of being casual, sort of letting go of presuppositions or prejudices. So it's invitational. Let's take a look at and then this other part of this thing that I'll point out is that you see this dialectic between what you might call the spiritual part of the self, the more inward part of the self, and the kind of empirical or material part of the self that's sort of in the world and sort of laboring and full of stresses and worries and is kind of trying to make its way. And then there's this part of the self that's quiet and sort of listens and reflects, and that's where the poetry comes from. And there's so Whitman has this dialectic of the soul and the body, and he interestingly sort of, as much as he wants them to come together, he treats them as two separate selves, as if they've been sort of totally cleaved apart, and he wants this kind of reconciling or healing of those two separate selves. And so you see here that the body sort of courts the soul and the soul courts the body. And poetry gets conflated with eroticism, with sexuality. The creative act is also this form of, maybe you think it's subtle or not so subtle, nod towards masturbation sort of self-love or self-eroticism. And we see that in other areas of Whitman's poetry where he essentially alludes to masturbating and then talks about guilt about that, because it was believed, and this image here is not really guilt-ridden, but some of his other moments are, where he calls his hand a marauder and things like that, because there was ideas at that time about, masturbation was called onanism, and there was a sort of belief that it was, it depleted your vital energies. But here, Whitman does seem to be associating sort of the vitality of the body and of the working body, or the laboring body with, or the masculine body with a kind of spiritual and poetic vitality as well. And then we have, we'll look at one or two more moments. We have another famous passage here. A child said, "What is the grass? Fetching it to me with full hands." How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift in remembrancer designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners that we may see and remark and say, "Whose?" Or I guess the grass is itself a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white. Canuck, Tuckahoe, Congressman Cuff, I give them the same, I receive them the same. That is, Canuck is Canadian, Tuckahoe refers to Native American, Congressman is Congressman, and Cuff was a term in the 19th century for a black person. And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. Tenderly will I use you curling grass. It may be you transpire from the breasts of young men. It may be if I had known them, I would have loved them. It may be you are from old people and from women and from offspring taken soon out of their mother's laps. And here you are the mother's laps. The grass is very dark to be from the white heads of old mothers. Darker than the colorless beards of old men, dark to come from under the faint red roofs of mouths. Oh, I perceive after so many uttering tongues, and I perceive they do not come from the roofs of mouths for nothing. I wish I could translate the hints about the dead young men and women, and the hints about old men and mothers, and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. What do you think has become of the young and old men? What do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death. And if ever there was, it led forward life and does not wait at the end to arrest it and cease the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward and nothing collapses. And to die is different from what anyone supposed and luckier. Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. So there's quite a shocking confidence in Whitman here about death, and we'll see later on if we're able to get to it, that during the Civil War and after the Civil War, his poetry becomes much more modest and much more chastened It doesn't have the kind of exuberance and optimism that it has here. But we also see, as he says shortly here after this, I am not an earth nor an adjunct of earth. I am the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as myself. They do not know how immortal, but I know. So part of what we're seeing in this whole section of the, it's sort of the famous section of the child fetching the grass and asking Whitman, what is the grass? We see that Whitman is interested in writing a poetry that is like grass, which is to say it is everywhere. And it's totally ordinary. And that becomes a metonym, that becomes metonymic for, the, people of America and the, cultures of America that, or social ecologies of America that, that is to say it's everywhere and it's, yet it's been neglected by poetry. And by being the poet of the grass, he's also the, he's the poet who speaks for the dead, as we see here, or is trying to translate the hints of the dead, but also the poet of the, of all these, of America in the sense of its ordinary pluralistic multitude. And he wants to sort of be the voice of the representative for that America that has not been represented in art and in poetry. That's why he says, I am the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as myself. So there's a kind of, there's a sense in which he, sacralizes the ordinary. He elevates through the act of poetry. He makes it the ordinary into something sacred. And he, you know, part of this idea would have been informed by, his reading of, Emerson's The American Scholar address, where Emerson talks about, I want to celebrate the near, the common, the low. Also, too, an interesting association with grass here is that grass was a term used to refer to the old pulp that newspaper was printed on. So it was called loose sheets or called grass. So there's a sense, too, that, you know, that the medium is democratic as much as the message is democratic. And he thinks of, and he, as a poet, is democratic. And so he thinks of himself as trying to capture that which is like the grass everywhere and yet neglected, and bring that into view in such a way that transfigures it or makes it into something beautiful and something transcendent. So there's, you know, this is why Whitman is often thought of as trying to sort of either heal the nation or unify the nation through his poetry. And that attempt at unification happens on the level of affection and even eroticism for the other. And maybe we could look at a great passage here where he says, the runaway slave came to my house and stopped outside. I heard his motions crackling the twigs of the woodpile. Through the swung half-door of the kitchen, I saw him limpsy and weak and went where he sat on a log and let him in and assured him and brought water and filled a tub for his sweated body and bruised feet. And gave him a room that entered from my own, and gave him some coarse, clean clothes, and remember perfectly well his revolving eyes and his awkwardness, and remember putting plasters on the galls of his neck and ankles. He stayed with me a week before he was recuperated and passed north. I had him sit next to me at table. My firelock leaned in the corner. So we see, and that's the firelock refers to, that's the rifle, right? So we see here, you know, an example of Whitman, sort of the poet welcoming the runaway slave. Whitman is, you know, it's, he's an interesting contradiction because in his life, he was committed to some degree to abolition or the idea of, he found slavery to be a grave injustice, but he was a little bit more to the center in his politics than someone like Emerson, Thoreau. He was sort of more committed to the cause of unionism and sort of bringing the country together. And he also in his private life or his life was known to say racist things. I mean, if you perhaps not. I mean, racism was so common at that time. Of course, it's common now, but the kind of language that Whitman used was maybe not necessarily a radical departure from the way most whites talked at that time. But if you look at his journals and his letters and some of the things he says, he drops the N-word a lot and things like that. So it's strange because, you know, the Whitman of the persona of the poems is much more generous than the Whitman the man when it came to that stuff. When it came to his treatment of African Americans and of race. But we have here an interesting sort of moment where the speaker of the poem takes in the runaway slave. I'm not sure what you make of the rifle leaning in the corner. It seems to imply a sense of trust. It may tap into anxieties that whites had at that time about the dangers of there was a major debate starting from the inception of the country and going into the 19th century about if slavery was put to an end. Whites had these fantastical fears about, you know, if slavery was put to an end, the freed slaves would murder all the whites. So perhaps Whitman is sort of gesturing to this kind of this hysteria on the part of white supremacist America that fantasizes about the dangers of the freed slave, and sort of creating this moment where the runaway slave and the poet can share a table together and have this kind of mutual trust. I'm not sure how I would love to in your responses to see how you take this passage. I also recommend there's the section right after this where Whitman is talking about the bathers, and it has its read that carefully because it has some interesting moments about female sexuality and about it's really a scene of orgiastic bliss of sort of group sex, it's interesting to sort of see how Whitman represents women or female sexuality in that passage and sort of contemplate sort of the ins and outs of that representation. Anyways, that's all for now.